Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. It's the news roundup where we discuss some of the regional stories making headlines this week. A new environmental report on the Cape Cod Bridges replacement project is out, and the state held an open house yesterday in Bourne to hear comments from the public. CAI's Jeanette Barnes was there, and she's joining us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So tell us about the report. I understand it's quite long.
Yes. Well, this is the draft environmental impact report. It's something that is required for major construction projects in order to evaluate what you might call kind of the side effects of the project. It's not just kind of traditional environmental issues like the wildlife habitat, but it also includes things like socioeconomics, conditions created by the project, construction noise, air quality, things like that. As you said, it is quite a lot to dig into. It is almost 1,000 pages plus 17 different appendices on different subjects, and some of those are hundreds of pages. But just to touch on a few things, with regard to wildlife, the report says that the effect on fish and shellfish in the canal would not be significant. This is not likely to harm habitat for North Atlantic right whales. They did say, though, the bridge construction could eliminate some habitat for monarch butterflies and kill some of the monarchs. Then on the economic side, no surprise there, the report says that not replacing the bridges would be catastrophic eventually for the Cape because those bridge closures that would happen for repair would make it very difficult to get both people and goods on and off the Cape.
What kinds of things were you hearing when you talked to people at the open house?
Well, for a lot of people there, that this environmental report that just came out really wasn't their focus. Many people were attending a bridge open house for the first time and just kind of learning more about the project. I did see some people studying the chart on greenhouse gas emissions, which was interesting because it shows emissions actually going down around the new bridges. I talked with Louisa Piwanski about that. She's the chief of the bridge project for the Healey administration. And she says the reason for those lower emissions is that vehicles won't be stuck idling in traffic, and idling is a significant contributor to air pollution. We do know that some people on the Cape have expressed the concern that more traffic and pollution will be actually coming onto the Cape if traffic moves more easily. But Piwanski says it's really not about making, bringing more traffic to the Cape. It's about making it easier for people who have to travel over the bridges in their daily lives and also for people who choose to visit.
What are the next steps on the bridge project?
Well, this environmental report is just in the draft form right now, although issuing the draft, this big thing, is probably the most significant step in the process and doesn't always get changed a lot. But it's in a public comment period now that runs through October 24th, and then the state will issue a final version. They also have to go through a very similar process with an environmental document at the federal level. And then both of those reports are probably the biggest lift in permitting. That's what this is about. And they have to file these reports and show what's going to happen to the environment in order to get their permits. Then they move on to other steps like procuring the architect and stuff.
And so any word on funding for the Bourne Bridge, which doesn't have federal funding yet, right?
That's right. So the state did apply August 1st for roughly $1 billion. But they have not heard yet. It's not late, though. They're expecting to hear later in the fall.
All right. Let's talk about the latest on the cleanup and demolition of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. The reactor building is scheduled to be demolished starting in 2031. But a lot of things have to happen before that. So what's happening right now?
One thing that's happening right now is testing of the soil and groundwater on the Pilgrim property for contamination. This is completely separate from the idea of the nuclear material that's in the water in the building. This includes things like industrial contaminants, metals, PFAS. PFAS have been found on the property before, but they don't appear to come from a single source. And this week, the State Department of Environmental Protection said that the owner of Pilgrim Holtec has filed the report, and it does seem to meet state requirements. But in the meantime, what's really standing in the way of that demolition of the reactor building is the dispute over the water inside it.
You also reported this week that federal officials from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are scheduled to speak to the state panel in November. So what's that all about?
Yeah, so they're likely to talk about some of the hot issues surrounding Pilgrim, like the water contamination inside the building, the role of Plymouth as a host community in the decommissioning of a plant, the storage of spent nuclear fuel over the long term, and things like that. One reason that this visit by the feds, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is going to be interesting is because they have so much authority over what happens at nuclear plants and how they're governed. And many times in these meetings, there are questions that just cannot be answered by someone other than them. And so having them present will be good for that. One thing, though, we know that the panel, the state panel on Pilgrim, asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to talk about environmental justice, because that's a hot issue in whether the waste, whether the radioactive water can or should be shipped to another state. Some people say that it's an environmental justice violation to put that in someone else's backyard. But the feds told the panel they cannot speak about an environmental justice issue. And the chairman of the panel said he was speculating that that's because of how the Trump administration views issues like that right now. One other thing just to point out that the questioning those federal guests could allow members of the panel to bring up topics that are very hard to bring up in a timely manner right now. There have been some changes to the panel that mean that it now takes 4 months to get something new on the agenda.
That's crazy. You were telling me about that. And is this a recent change? I mean, why does it take so long?
Well, part of it is new this year and part isn't. So first of all, the panel only meets every 2 months. But this year, the new chair said that in the past, discussions about what to put on the agenda were happening too privately in between meetings, and that he felt it was a violation of the open meeting law. So he wants those conversations about what to put on the agenda to happen in public in the meeting. So right then, you have to put something on, you have to talk about something, vote to put it on the agenda 2 months later. But the second factor is that several members of this panel work for the Healey administration, and they feel they can't even vote on whether to put something on the agenda until they've gone back to their boss, talk to them, and then come back to the next meeting. So now you have this compounded. It takes 4 months.
Wow. All right, before you go, let's touch on the offshore wind news this week. On Monday, a federal judge ruled that work can resume on building a wind farm called Revolution Wind. The project's been under a stop work order from the Trump administration since August. So tell us why this is significant.
Yeah, so as many of our listeners know, the offshore wind industry has been in a real struggle with the Trump administration, starting from day one when the president issued an order halting the permitting of offshore wind. So in this case, the judge's order allowing construction on Revolution Wind to continue, it was a win for offshore wind for the industry among many losses that are happening right now. But it's a preliminary injunction, which is temporary. It is not actually the ruling in the lawsuit. So the developers of Revolution Wind are suing the Trump administration over the stop work order. This injunction allows the construction to go ahead while the lawsuit is proceeding in the background. I think it's interesting that the law here seems to favor projects that are already under construction. The Trump administration had issued a stop work order on a New York project, Empire Wind, and then lifted it later. Revolution Wind is largely almost complete, and it is a Rhode Island and Connecticut project. So the power is not coming into Massachusetts, but this wind farm is pretty close to the vineyard, though. It is actually southwest of Martha's Vineyard. The turbines are visible from Aquinnah.
Tell us more about this ruling. What did the judge have to say?
Sure. This is in federal court in Washington, D.C. The judge said that stopping the construction was what he called the height of arbitrary and capricious action, which, of course, is something that is going to cause a problem for the decision. And he said that the government here, the Trump administration, failed to cite any factual information to support their pause of the project. The Trump administration has said it was a national security issue. The judge is saying that's not in evidence. The New England News Collaborative actually did the reporting on this decision. I mean, we have that on our website. And the judge also talked about the irreparable harm in this case to both the developer and to the workers. He said that the developer of Revolution Wind, which is called Ørsted, was losing $2.3 million a day, and that hundreds of people were out of work, of course, while the construction was stopped.
And you mentioned Revolution was almost complete.
Right. It's at least 80% complete. It's a 65-turbine project, and that power is going to be going to Rhode Island and Connecticut. That's enough power for 350,000 homes. Mm. We don't talk about this one quite as much because, as I said, it's not a Massachusetts project. It is being staged out of New London, Connecticut. But it's interesting that an injunction like this, it allows the work to go forward, could be somewhat protective of other projects that are partially built, which includes Vineyard Wind.
Okay. CAI's Jeanette Barnes, thank you.
Thanks, Mindy.
All right. This summer, a team of international scientists spent 3 months drilling for freshwater south of Nantucket. CAI science reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes has been speaking with some of the scientists involved in the project, and she's here to talk about that. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
All right. So they went looking for freshwater under the seafloor. They found it.
They did, yeah. Not a lot, but some. What they did find a lot of was brackish water, which, as you know, is saltier than drinking water, but not as salty as seawater.
So is the fresh water they found drinkable?
Well, judging by just the salinity, yes, but there are other factors to examine. They've sent samples out to labs all over the world for testing. They want to know what kinds of microbes live in the water, what they feed off of, how old the water is. They don't know if this aquifer is connected to our aquifers on land, if it gets replenished, or if it's been trapped there since the last ice age or the ice age before that or even longer.
So many questions. So is this type of aquifer unique to our region?
No. Brandon Dugan, who was chief scientist on the project, he was one of three chief scientists on the project, says there are undersea aquifers off every continent on the planet.
Who knew?
Including Antarctica.
Wow. But
this is the first time scientists have really drilled down into one and undergone this level of research.
So why were they drilling?
Well, they were drilling... Three drill sites starting about 20 miles south of Nantucket. The closest site to land was just east of the wind farm. Teams were out there 24 hours a day for 93 days. They worked 2 12-hour shifts a day drilling down and bringing up core samples for studying.
So who's studying the core samples?
Some of them are already being studied in various labs around the globe because this is truly an international effort and it was internationally financed as well. Dugan says he's working with over 40 scientists from 16 countries. But the vast majority of the material is headed to the University of Bremen in Germany. And just after the new year, all the scientists working on the project will come together to examine and test the cores there in Bremen. And some of the cores will be held in the repository there for anyone who wants to study a sample in perpetuity.
Wow. Has any data come back yet from the labs?
Yes. Dugan says it started to trickle in. So far, they have some results that indicate the water likely came from a glacier, and they believe it is tens of thousands of years old, but more detailed answers are still to come in the months and years.
So do the scientists think that these aquifers will be tapped for drinking water someday?
The scientists I spoke to do think that will happen in a matter of decades, although they caution that it would be very expensive and there are a lot of potential consequences that need to be addressed before that happens.
Right. Another story that you reported on, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission is seeking public comments on a draft regulation addendum which considers options for management measures to support rebuilding the striped bass stock by 2029. How can locals let their opinions be known?
A couple of ways. The ASMFC is currently hosting a series of hearings and will accept written public comment through Friday, October October 3rd. And there'll be a local hearing next Tuesday, September 30th at 6 p.m. at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy in Buzzards Bay. And people can attend that either in person or by Zoom.
And why is this happening?
Well, striped bass were declared overfished back in 2019, and the goal was to rebuild the stock by 2029. And according to the most recent stock assessment in 2024, the population is not on track to meet the target.
So what are the regulators proposing?
The draft rules aim to reduce the catch by 12% in both the recreation and commercial sectors. They're considering a couple of different ways to do that. One is a quota reduction for the commercial fishery. If approved, Massachusetts commercial quota would be reduced by about 82,000 pounds for 2026. The Mass Division of Marine Fisheries projects this will result in one or two fewer open fishing days than occurred this year. The 2025 commercial fishery occurred over 15 days this year between June 17th and August 5th. And another is season closures and or size limit changes for the recreational fishery. And if approved, this could result in anglers not being allowed to harvest or target striped bass for roughly 1 to 2 months a year. The proposal considers both no harvest seasons, which means no keeping striped bass, and no targeting seasons or no fishing for striped bass. And these closures would be implemented for either the whole region, Maine to North Carolina, or two regions, North and South. The North region would run from either Rhode Island to Maine or Massachusetts to Maine. That's yet to be determined. And striped bass are migratory, so impacts of each option proposed differ based on when striped bass are available to anglers in different areas during different times of the year.
I imagine other options being floated.
Yes, a few things. They're proposing requiring commercial tagging at the point of harvest to reduce the risk of illegal harvest. Commercial tagging programs are already required, but states get to decide if it happens at the point of harvest or the point of sale. Massachusetts is one of three states with a point of sale tagging program currently. And the proposal also considers a coastwide definition of how to measure the total length of a striped bass. This addresses concerns that inconsistent measurement methods undermine conservation. And regulators here say this is largely consistent with Massachusetts' current rules, so not a big change for us. And then finally, for Maryland, it considers adjusting the timing of the recreational season in the Chesapeake Bay fishery.
So when will we know what changes are going to be put in place?
The ASMFC Striped Bass Management Board is expected to vote on a final proposal next month for implementation by the states in 2026. So once approved, MassDMF would develop corresponding state regulations through the Marine Fishery Advisories Commission and a public process. That would happen later this year.
All right. CAI Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyce. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Mindy.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, was on the Vineyard this week and met with some protests. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
So why was RFK Jr. here?
Right. He was here. There's this kind of national tribe group called the Secretary's Tribal Advisory Committee, made up of kind of tribal nation representatives from across the country. They generally meet in D.C., but once a year they have this meeting where they hear from and essentially lobby some of the top policy makers in the executive branch, the CDC, Health and Human Services, things like that. And Kennedy was part of that.
Yeah. And so tell us about the protesters.
So Kennedy arrived on a Cape Air flight Tuesday. At the airport, he was met with dozens of protesters there, maybe up to 100. Then he drove up to Aquinnah, where there was an entourage. There was met by another much larger group of protesters. It was up to about 100, and I guess there was maybe one other protest in Aquinnah. But protesters were basically calling to support science and similar to, I guess, on Monday, there was that strange press conference when President Trump and Kennedy made these kind of unsubstantiated remarks on Tylenol, that women shouldn't take, pregnant women shouldn't take Tylenol. But, right, protesters were kind of saying he's been boosting kind of these unsubstantiated claims. I think the big one on people's minds was mainly that vaccines cause autism, statements that have been widely criticized by the healthcare community. Kind of interesting that the moment his caravan or entourage drove through this main protest, there were shouts of quack, and we have a video of the interaction. It's gone somewhat viral on our website, Vineyard's really showing up and taking a stand.
Yeah. Now, the story of, public transit on the Vineyard is miles ahead, it seems to me, of others in the region. You truly can get just about anywhere you want to go on the bus. And some great news, free rides are going to continue?
Now, this is kind of a neat story. Like free bus rides, the program started a few years ago, but it really started slow, something like it was 1 month out of the year that bus rides were free. Then last year was a good chunk of the year, but not over the summer. And then this past season, it's been free for pretty much the whole year, right through the summer. It was supposed to end on Tuesday, but the state has agreed to continue it at least through May. And the funding for these free rides comes from this millionaire's tax. Listeners probably remember voters passed at the ballot a few years ago. But we're finding, and this isn't just the Vineyard, but really across the state, it's been really successful. The head of the island's bus service, the VTA, said this summer felt like a return to the glory days of public transit. She noted there were something like 9,000 to 10,000 riders a day in July and August, a big boost from a few years ago. I think one stat I thought was interesting, this June, there was actually more bus riders compared to August last year.
Wow.
Because August is kind of the big month here. Yeah. But we also saw on the South Coast, there's been a huge increase. And I guess Cape Cod Regional Transit is going to be getting the free program as well, if it hasn't already.
Yeah. All right. So not only can you get anywhere you want to go, you can get there for free.
Yeah, it's nice. It also went kind of anecdote, it makes everything run faster. You don't have to stand there for a minute to pay. It smooths everything out. So we had an editorial just praising the program, and getting cars off the road is always good.
A win-win. Yeah. Sam Houghton for the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, charges are dropped against a Falmouth man accused of threatening a school shooting. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point and the Weekly News Roundup. Cape and Islands District Attorney dropped charges against an 18-year-old Falmouth man who was accused of threatening a school shooting. Callie Remillard from the Enterprise Newspapers is here with more. What's the latest on this, Callie?
Hi, Mindy. So I have a little update for you. Yesterday around 4 p.m., our newsroom got a press release from the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office. And this announced that they discovered during their investigation a discrepancy, what they're calling a discrepancy, into the alleged threats. And whatever this discrepancy was that they found essentially made it impossible to pursue further prosecution of this case in Barnstable District Court. So they had to enter in a nolle prosequi, which essentially is just saying that they're not going to prosecute this any further.
But they say the investigation is continuing.
Yes, the investigation is still ongoing. There are additional charges and warrants that there could be, they could bring those charges forward. But the investigation is still ongoing, so they haven't been able to say much else about it. But this is the news that we got yesterday.
Yeah. I should mention that CBB is reporting, WCBB in Boston is reporting, that Cape and Islands Assistant District Attorney Tom Flanagan wrote in the affidavit, after further investigation, including review of records and witness interviews, the Commonwealth has determined that the 911 caller who reported the threats on August 28th and later advised Falmouth police personnel that the verbal threats were recently made during August 2025 was wrong, and said the reports of a recent August 2025 threat were inaccurate. And Fotheringham's defense attorney told WCVB that the 911 caller was someone who had access to his juvenile records and that they were reporting information from when he was a juvenile and not recent statements. So still a lot of confusion around this case on, what is going on, but at least police are still looking into it, and hopefully we'll hear more. Right?
Yes, they are still looking into it. And another thing they noted in the press release, because the community's been, really on edge.
Yes.
Parents are really on edge, and the Falmouth police did say in their press release that they are doing everything in their ability to, you know, provide protection for the students at the schools and keep the school community informed. Yeah. So this is definitely a developing story that we're
indoor
following.
Indoor recess, no sports outside, and police presence at the school. So,
yes.
All right. Another story you reported on this week, Callie, the Bayview Campground in Bourne. It's a pretty popular place for lots of people staying for the season. And word is they're going to close because of septic issues.
Yes. So if you've ever driven south from the Bourne Rotary down Route 28, you've seen Bayview. They've got this sign, these sort of like red piles with this big blue Bayview sign.
I've always been curious and want to go in there.
You know, I've actually been there. I went when I was a little girl. It's nice in there. But I guess what's going on is that they have sort of this hodgepodge of outdated and leaky septic systems and cesspits and whatnot. And the Buzzards Bay Coalition actually put some pressure on them and got in touch with Mass DEP. And just a few weeks ago, we got word that they had signed an administrative consent order, which essentially gave them like 5 to 7 years to tear up the campground and completely resewer it. And, you know, when we spoke to the attorney for Bayview, he was excited about this. And he was like, you know, we're ready to do the work. And then on Saturday, it was announced actually on Facebook. That's how a lot of the campers found out that Bayview would be closing after the 2026 season because they essentially just can't afford the massive price tag that comes along with the work needed to remedy the pollution.
Yeah. 46 acres and over 400 campsites. That's a big piece of property, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure a lot of folks are going, whoa, wait a minute, I've already paid for the next season, mm-hmm. but they can get their money back.
Yeah, so there is, Bayview is offering that, you know, anyone looking to get the refund for the 2026 deposit that they just paid would have to clear their campground by October 15th, which is coming up really quick. And a lot of these campers, you know, they're big. They've got decks built onto them. It's a whole site that's built out. And they would have to, you know, tear that whole thing down and essentially vacate the camp within just a couple weeks.
I'm sure more to come on this. Callie Romelard from the Enterprise Newspapers. Callie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mindy.
60 Minutes featured a segment on the possibility of genetically modified mice being able to help curb the spread of Lyme disease on Nantucket. Josh Balling from the Enquirer and Mirror joins us. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
All right, Josh, this isn't the first time we heard about this, right? Researchers at MIT have been working on this for a little bit, but what's the latest?
The latest is really basically the 60 Minutes episode. They were out here last year, came to the island, talked to some of the doctors out here, and did a piece on that research that has been going on for 5 years or so. We first wrote about this at least 3 or 4 years ago when the researchers at MIT began working and began looking into whether genetically modified mice could be used as a way to combat Lyme disease. The episode that aired on Sunday night did some in-depth interviews with island doctor Tim Leprey, who is one of the country's foremost experts on tick-borne diseases, and several island residents who've been impacted by Lyme disease. Nantucket has one of the highest, if not the highest, incidences of tick-borne disease, particularly Lyme, in the country. Last October, and we reported this, that the researchers at MIT had a breakthrough. They created the first genetically modified mouse completely resistant to the Lyme bacteria, though that was also capable of passing that immunity on to their offspring. The idea is to eventually introduce those mice to Nantucket and elsewhere where there's a high incidence of tick-borne diseases, where they will breed with existing mice and create Lyme immune generations moving forward.
Wow, it's just fascinating, isn't it? And, you know, I didn't realize this, but we did a show recently on ticks, and Stephen Rich, who does a lot of the research over at UMass Amherst, was saying that there are more cases of Lyme disease per year than there are HIV, which I found so shocking, but I guess it makes sense.
It does. And, you know, lots of people are concerned about deer. That's another big problem on Nantucket, as anybody who could read the Enquirer and Mirror knows. But mice are actually the main carriers of the Lyme bacteria. They're the ones that pass the disease along to the ticks, which then infect humans. Deer are basically just big hosts, and they allow the ticks to survive and then go latch on to human beings and dogs and everyone else.
Great. All right. Another story. I have the Steamship Authority facing some scrutiny over freight boats. What's going on there?
These are the three new freight boats, or new to the Steamship Authority anyway, that they've brought online in the last 6 months or so. They've been touted as being safer, more reliable upgrades to the aging fleet of freight boats that the Steamship Authority has. But they're facing pretty stiff criticism, even from some of the crew members who work on them. They say the boats are too slow to keep to the schedule between Hyannis and Nantucket. They draw too much water in Hyannis Harbor and require major adjustments just to meet Coast Guard requirements. They've also reported sewage backups and rust-colored water coming from the taps on the boats, raising real questions about whether these boats, which cost the Steamship Authority nearly $85 million total to purchase and refurbish, are creating more problems than they solve. Steamship Authority officials reject that notion that the boats are flawed. They say there's always a trying out period and a getting adjusted period. And they describe the issues so far really as glitches that are common when a vessel begins a new operational life, pointing to other boats like the Car Ferry Eagle and the hybrid freight and car ferry Woods Hole that had similar issues or other issues that were eventually resolved once they were on the routes for a while.
All right. So if these glitches can't be worked out, then what happens next?
Then there's going to be some issues with making the making the scheduled time back and forth. They've already revised a few things. They got a new letter of draft from the Coast Guard, which allows them to draw some more water to load the more fully, which was another concern that they were not being able to load as many vehicles and trucks in particular onto the boats, which was a big selling point when they bought them. The other big selling point was the fact that they were formerly used boats. They were used in the offshore oil rig business in the Gulf of Mexico. And again, they paid just under $90 million all in to purchase and then completely refurbish them, which was quite a bit of an overrun from originally estimated. But the Steamship Authority officials, including Rob Ranney from Nantucket, say that a new freight boat like the hybrid Woods Hole would cost $45 to $50 million alone.
Wow.
To build. So getting three boats for 90 instead of instead of one for 45, they say that once they get these issues worked out, they will be worth the money.
All right, Josh Bolling with the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Town of Chatham has been looking at possible solutions to its parking problem in the downtown area. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle is joining us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so we've got some solutions. One of them, paid parking in several downtown lots.
Yeah, the Board of Selectmen last week on the recommendation of a report by the Cape Cod Commission voted 3-2 to start charging in three main parking lots in the downtown area. Now, their purpose here is to try to sort of move some of the traffic and congestion from downtown Chatham into several outlying parking lots, rather than having people sort of circling in the downtown area looking for parking spaces. By charging in these downtown lots but not charging in the outer lots, they're hoping people will opt to park there. One of the proposals that they also adopted, that they're asking the town manager to develop a plan for implementation, involves having a free shuttle that will bring folks from those outlying parking lots into the downtown area.
Yeah, so park free out here and get the free shuttle.
That's the idea, yeah. This has been, it's been something that's been discussed for years, and the board finally bit the bullet on it. It wasn't, as I said, it wasn't unanimous. A couple board members thought that it was a little premature, but they'll have another opportunity to review the situation when the town manager develops an implementation report on this. And it's also likely to have to go to town meeting for funding for kiosks or whatever system is developed for parking.
Right, and then the Chatham Unitarian Universalist Meeting House pausing the use of its property for protests. What led to that decision?
There have been two sort of major protests held on the UU Meeting House lawn here in Chatham. It's a very visible spot. It's right near downtown. It's the church is on a little hill with a beautiful sloping lawn, and it gets a lot of traffic in that area. Basically, there's been a new board that's come into the UU Meeting House, and a group that had sponsored the previous protests, who call themselves What Now, and they had planned another protest for this weekend, actually, but there had been a communications glitch, and they hadn't informed the board about that. So that protest was canceled, but in their discussions, they decided to allow a protest planned for October 18th. It's the No Kings 2.0 National Protest Day. That's going to go forward, but the board said that, given the tenor of the times and just everything that's happening around political rhetoric and politicalization of protests like this, they're going to pause. They're not going to allow any more after this October 18th. And they're suggesting that the local group, this one or others, find other venues like, town parks or town property to hold protests.
Yeah. All right. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, the latest from the State House. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. For the past 6 years, a group of New Bedford residents has been fighting a proposal to build what would have been the biggest waste transfer facility in Massachusetts. But as Brooke Kushwaha of the New Bedford Light reports, that fight may be coming to an end. The city's Board of Health voted against the proposal in a 2-1 decision. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with Brooke to learn more about what comes next.
Take me back to the very beginning of this project. For folks who aren't familiar, what exactly was being proposed in New Bedford by the company Parallel Products?
So this project has been in the works for about 6 years. Parallel Products is a national company that deals primarily with recycling. They run a glass recycling plant in New Bedford. And in 2019, they asked to build what would have been the largest waste transfer station in the state at that plant. Unlike recycling, a waste transfer station deals with all kinds of solid waste. And initially, the proposal also included biosolids, which is a byproduct of treating sewage. Waste transfer stations, they don't process any of the waste. It's not like a landfill. It basically just sorts it, extracts any valuable materials that might be hiding in there, and then ships it to its final destination, whether that's an out-of-state landfill or an incinerator or something like that.
This project clearly had a very strong opposition. So who were the folks fighting this proposal, and what were their main concerns?
So it was largely the neighbors of what would have been this plant fighting it. Some of them lived as close as 500 feet away from the proposed facility. And the concerns they had were pretty typical to a waste facility. Noise was a concern, odor, traffic was a big concern. This facility would have had nearly 200 trucks passing through each day. They were also concerned about fire safety and rodent control. Across the city, another waste transfer station that already exists had a fire earlier this year that led to a rodent infestation in the surrounding neighborhood. So that was also very top of mind.
The Board of Health heard this proposal last week and voted it down in a split decision. What did Board of Health members who voted against the proposal have to say about it? And what about the one member who voted yes?
So the two board members, they had pretty similar concerns to the residents. One of the biggest things was they didn't believe that the company had adequate plans to control traffic. Like I said, it would be, you know, hundreds of trucks passing through each day. And the mitigation plan basically was like, well, the city could put in a stoplight, which they didn't see was taking enough responsibility. The other piece was vermin, like I said earlier as well. There was no pest control expert testifying during this review process, which they saw as a red flag. The person in favor of the project had these same concerns, but her reasoning was if they didn't approve it and then Parallel Products chose to appeal this decision and then won that appeal, they would lose their chance to put in any kind of safety guards.
Is this the end of the road for this proposal, or is there more to come?
So Parallel Products has not confirmed whether or not they plan to appeal this decision. If they did, they would have to prove that the Board of Health did not have, you know, legitimate reasons to pass up this proposal. So we're kind of in a holding pattern. But for now, neighbors have a reason to celebrate. Parallel Products has a reason to go back to the drawing board a little bit.
That's Brooke Kushwaha of the New Bedford Light. Brooke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
How does the state plan to evaluate students' eligibility to graduate without the MCAS? And what was a puppy doing in a legislative hearing? Again, CAI's Gilda Geis caught up with State House reporter Katie Lannon, who answered these questions and more with the latest from Beacon Hill.
Last fall, Massachusetts voters chose to eliminate the MCAS test as a graduation requirement. Now that the school year is underway, how is the state planning to measure whether students are eligible to graduate?
It's kind of an ongoing process because at this point, there's an interim requirement in place, including completion of some specific coursework, but individual districts are still developing their own local policies and graduation requirements. And meanwhile, there is a statewide graduation council working on the specifics of what a new statewide standard might look like. They put out kind of their first set of ideals this week, announcing what they call a vision of a high school graduate. So what these state officials are looking at is to have high school graduates who are creative problem solvers, who are self-aware, who can communicate effectively, make responsible decisions, and collaborate intentionally with others, as well as being academically prepared.
What do the Massachusetts Teachers Association and other stakeholders have to say about the council's new vision?
A lot of the reaction has called this a good first step. There's a positive feeling about this being more than about just grades or test scores. But the Teachers Association wants to really hold the state to this vision and make sure they back it up with the necessary resources and keep educators in the driver's seat.
State Rep. Stephen Exaros of Barnstable is sponsoring a couple bills heard at the State House this week that would increase protections for police dogs. So what is he proposing?
One of these bills builds on Nero's Law after the Yarmouth canine who was injured in the line of duty. And it would allow, if first responders are transporting a dog, as they're allowed to under that law, they'd also be able to provide certain advanced care to a police canine beyond the standard level of treatment. The other one has to do with retired police dogs, and it would essentially treat them like retired public workers, helping provide medical benefits for them so their handlers, their new families can pay for what can often be pretty complex care needs if these dogs have encountered trauma.
Who weighed in on the bills? Can you give us some of the highlights of what folks had to say?
Yeah, lawmakers heard from a retired state trooper who talked about what his experience with retired canines and caring for them had been like. But I think some of the most compelling testimony for the lawmakers came from Nyx, the cartoonishly adorable comfort dog over at the Barnstable Sheriff's Department, who at one point was actually licking the face of the committee chairman and I think just about had him ready to pass whatever bills Nyx wanted.
That is some pretty compelling testimony. All right, that's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brazilians are the largest immigrant community in Massachusetts. They're also being arrested in larger numbers by federal agents across the state. Philip Martin says fear is ricocheting throughout the community.
On a recent Saturday afternoon on Main Street in Marlboro, only a sprinkling of people are going in and out of normally bustling Brazilian cafes and shops.
I think a good indicator of the Brazilian community is how many Brazilian bakeries, restaurants, shops that you see.
27-year-old Renata Nunes was raised in the suburban city that is one of the largest concentrations of Brazilians in the state. Now, she says, she is seeing fewer people at cafes, shops, and bakeries owned by Brazilian entrepreneurs. Until recently, she worked at a charter school in nearby Framingham with a majority Brazilian student body. A lot has changed in a year, she says.
I had kids that were not going to school for weeks because their parents were afraid of an ice crack down at the school. And also the estheticians, the people at the salon that we know, the contractors that we know, some of them haven't been going to work. When they do go to work, they take a lot of precautions. They're always checking their surroundings.
There's an estimated 140,000 Brazilians in the state. The majority are foreign-born, research shows. Now they are also being picked up by federal agents in larger numbers. Since January, some 780 people from Brazil were apprehended by federal agents, about a quarter of all immigrants detained this year, according to the nonprofit Deportation Data Project. That's nearly three times as many as all Brazilians who were detained in the state last year, data shows. Why Brazilians in Massachusetts are being targeted is no mystery, says Graham Blair of the Data Project. He says as the largest non-citizen population in the state, they are easy pickings for ICE, which needs to fill a daily quota.
I think what we're seeing is that the Trump administration is looking across the country at the way that it can arrest, detain, and deport the most number of people in the shortest amount of time.
It's creating panic in this Portuguese-speaking community. One flight up a set of creaky wooden stairs of this graffiti-marked building in Austin is the Brazilian Workers' Center. Executive Director Lenita Reason says dozens of immigrants have been walking through these doors or telephoning nonstop since ICE staged its first major raid in the Boston area in the spring.
Every day of the week, ICE was around here, Commonwealth, Linden Street. So people was calling us and say, ICE is here. We see a car. So people was very stressed. Every time they were seeing a black car or a car with a windows with shade, they was stressed.
Sinvalda Oliveira of Marlboro, an esthetician, says that's bad for business and morale.
We're going to all go broke because our client is gone. All the bakeries, all the markets, because now we're not making enough money to pay our employees. It's crazy. It's horrible. It's not right.
Oliveira is a naturalized U.S. citizen and says these deportations are not what she expected when she voted for Donald Trump. She's not alone. Like her, local Brazilians lean conservative as a community, according to researchers who cite evangelical Christian belief as a major factor.
I was raised with very conscious family values, religion.
She says that's why she also supported former right-wing Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro, who professes to be a religious man.
I vote for Bolsonaro because of that, and I vote for Trump because of that, too.
But now she's changing her mind. She says she may sit out the next U.S. presidential election altogether.
If the things is still going sour, I'm going to skip it. I'm not going to vote at all because I don't want to be part of that. It's not normal. We cannot leave afraid.
Taylor Boas, a Boston University Latin American expert, says many other Brazilians, like Latino voters broadly speaking, are also having second thoughts about what they believe.
Things are changing. We've known for a long time that immigration has been an issue, but using ICE aggressively to round people up off the streets is something new. And so, people's attitudes are evolving.
Not everyone. Some Brazilians have been unswayed politically by the targeting of their community by federal agents acting under the direction of President Trump. Eloisa Maria Gaval of the nonprofit Brazil Women's Group in Brighton says she's seen it up close.
We had a man who was deported to Brazil. He has 6 kids born in the United States. He was campaigning for Trump. And I was getting messages on social media of people saying, why are you helping him? He voted for Trump. And I said, I don't care if he voted for Trump. He is a human being and he needs help right now.
Others say they are too stressed with daily pressures to worry about politics. Take this woman GBH News met in August, who was waiting anxiously at the Brazilian Workers Center for a rideshare voucher for a one-way trip to Logan Airport. Her husband was arrested months ago and is sitting in an ICE detention center in Louisiana. She says she wants to avoid the same fate for her and her children. And what happened to your husband?
Imigração pegou, tá preso.
The immigration detained him.
Em desespero, desespero total. Os meninos só choram, medo.
I was terrified, my kids just crying because they are afraid.
The airplane carrying her and her children landed in Belo Horizonte 18 hours after leaving Logan. Upon arrival, she spoke to a freelance reporter in collaboration with GBH about her concerns. I don't know what I'm going to do now. I'm sort of lost, she said. I left there kind of lost, and I arrived here kind of lost. As ICE launches new raids, it's likely many more Brazilians will be leaving like this woman or retreating into the shadows.
That's Philip Martin reporting for Connecting the Commonwealth. And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.